You're listening to the oneofus.net podcast network. Hey, Patience, what are you doing here?
Oh, I'm just hanging out, drinking some beer.
Yeah, okay, well, what do you got there?
I have this delicious Bud Light. Why are you looking at me like that?
You're drinking a fucking Bud Light?
Well, yeah, I mean...
Have you been to the bar? You see there's other beers there? Okay, do you see what I'm drinking?
Well, yeah, you're drinking, what is that, a little yellow pill?
Yeah, it's an Oscar Blues beer. They're a local Austin brewery. Well, they have two in Denver and they have one in North Carolina, but they're really good. Look, you know what? I know that you've been sold by the man to think that maybe these Budweiser, they're all American or something, but nothing's more American than a craft brewery like Oscar Blues Brewery, right? You know what? Here, I'm just gonna throw that over there.
Okay.
There you go. Now drink this. Mama's little yellow pills.
Fine. Oh, that's actually doesn't taste like piss water. It's really, really good.
Exactly. It's for people who don't want to drink piss water, who want light and refreshing without piss water.
You changed my life, Chris.
You're so welcome. This is Fantastic Fest. We're on day 5, and boy, are we tired.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. You kind of dragged me around. We're like, we're going to go record, and I just sort of willingly followed. I said, oh, okay.
Yeah, it's just like being a farmer, really. Just like, open the gate, and the sheep just come right in.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sorry, I just described Matt Mongold as a sheep, but he works for the Austin Chronicle. So, wait, now that actually is kind of accurate.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's just, yeah, people with beards tell me what to do. That's sort of my living when it comes to film.
You have a beard?
I know. That's why I should be in charge.
Someday you'll be the beard in charge.
That is fair.
We've seen a lot of movies during this fest, and we still have a lot more to cover. As I said, Matt here, my colleague from the Austin Chronicle, where you can go and check out all of their stories, various written ones, other interviews on Fantastic Fest at austinchronicle.com. I'm Chris Cox from oneofus.net, where you can come see not just stuff about Fantastic Fest, but stuff about all the movies, TV shows, books, wrestling, which our own Richard Whitaker, actually from the Chronicle, does the show for us on, believe it or not. There's a guy that you never would suspect is really, really into wrestling, right?
I've given up ever trying to assume what Richard is weirdly an expert on.
Indeed. Well, let's go do our first movie we're going to take a look at, and we briefly mentioned this on yesterday's podcast because it is by director Tahanto?
Sounds right.
Okay, I guess I think Richard had it better than I did, who did The Night Comes for Us, which is a big, giant Iko Uwe horror film, but he's also represented this year with his film May the Devil Take You, which is, in the director's own words, but I'm going to disagree with him, an Evil Dead ripoff. When I was talking to him, that's how he described it. I was like, you mean tribute, don't you?
Yeah, it is definitely, there is Evil Dead in its DNA, along, you know, everything from the possessions and the style and the way that they do the makeup in order to represent the possessions to some of the bigger and louder horror action beats in the film. You know, it is whether he can say it's a ripoff, we can say it's an homage, but whatever it is, it's clearly somebody who grew up on a certain type of possession film, on a certain type of, you know, midnight horror movie, and is really just having a blast going back and remaking some of the stuff that he used to love watching growing up. So if you're a fan of Evil Dead, or even if you're not, I don't think you should let that worry you too much. There's enough stuff, clearly enough cultural specificity and stuff that it's not going to feel just like a beat for beat remake, but it has that energy level that the Evil Dead films have.
When we're introduced to the story, it's many years before the primary story, where the guy is clearly making a deal with some sort of occultist, a white-robed woman that he invites into his home. She's crafting a spell. Crazy stuff starts to happen. And as we go through the credit sequence, it's clear the spell, whatever it was one to give him riches and power, and he becomes very successful. But then as the credits go on and we see newspaper clippings, it's like, oh, all that started to fall away. Mm-hmm. And his previous wife died, and he's gotten married again to a famous celebrity. And when we're joined by the original, the daughter he had with said original wife, who's now all grown up, and he's dying. He's in a hospital covered with boils, incommunicado. She's coming, Alfie is coming to visit him for literally, or any of the step family she has for the first time in God knows how long. and she is not very happy to be there at all. But part of the deal is that he left behind the original house she grew up in, which apparently no one's really been in a while. Mm-hmm. And it was left to her specifically in his will. So she goes out there and the whole family goes out there. And there's a lot of sort of evil stepmother elements happening here. And a sort of questioning of which of the step family is genuinely trying to be nice to her and which are kind of like two-faced. But as they're messing around in this villa, they discover there's some gross, weird occult stuff going on in here. And before you know it, Henrietta in the basement, as it were, yep. pops out. And starts killing and possessing people. And it's, okay, for lack of a better term, it really is something it feels like it's in the Evil Dead universe.
Yeah, and it is interesting because I think, you know, I was watching it, one of the fun things about attending something like Fantastic Fest is sort of seeing the themes between films emerge in real time. And this movie, although it's not a huge part, like the second half is just action, horror action. It's just a lot of fun. But it does kind of set up an interesting premise, which is the idea of somebody who would sell his own daughter's soul in order to get ahead in the world. And then, you know, when later on they come calling for the commitments that he's made, he tries to weasel out of it. But it was kind of interesting because there has been a theme of this poverty, economic anxiety that's been not only just in horror films, but in action movies and some of the dramas that have been here, too. So this is one of those movies where I'm like, all right, it's a ton of fun. You're really going to enjoy it. But like there is that kernel of a smart idea as well, that I feel like this is going to be something people are going to talk about for a while to come. People aren't long after they're like, all right, it's Evil Dead ripoff. They're going to be like, hey, what did it say about the era we live in when this movie is basically like, oh yeah, like he sold his daughter's soul and like everybody's cool with that and it goes on from there. It felt like something that was kind of timely. And whenever you have good high-craft horror films that are also a little timely, that is perfect.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. There's definitely subtext here, but I think that it's not to worry you guys who are like, I don't want to watch a smart horror movie. This turns into just a fun roller coaster ride of a horror film with just lots of thrills and chills and super creepy stuff happening. And even the things that are nods to The Evil Dead are only nods. It's never like, oh, that's right out of The Evil Dead. It's like there's just like a frame that'll be like, or something they do but do so differently that it's clear that it's a tip of the hat to its inspiration, but not them just doing the same thing. I had a lot of fun with this. A lot of good practical effects as well.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. They do have some ideas that are theirs and theirs alone. There's a whole subplot involving voodoo dolls that you wouldn't see in The Evil Dead universe, but how Timo and his crew use those and how inventive the visuals get as a result of that. Like, that is a very good reason, if not the reason, to see this movie.
Well, our next film we're going to talk about is a French film called Savage that, despite the title sounds like it's going to be like a hardcore bloody horror film.
Right.
But your first clue that it's not is that it's a French film. Which, you know, I mean, they do make those, Martyrs and what have you.
Oh, sure.
But, like, I find a lot of times Fantastic Fest, the ones we get are actually a lot more cerebral. And that's the case here. It's south of France. It's a campground where lots of people go to vacation for the summer. Like literally a community of campers that are there all summer long. And our main character is Lily Rose Depp, who apparently speaks fluent French, which I guess is not surprising since she grew up in France. Mm-hmm. She, with her cousin, they spend their days basically being kind of minor juvenile delinquents there, deciding which boys they like or don't like. Laura, Lily Rose Depp, is definitely different from everyone else. She seems a little just disenchanted with this whole what things you're expected to do when you're a teenager thing. And that goes up to and including having crushes on teenage boys.
Yeah.
Because she's got a weird sort of obsession with a writer, that an older man writer who lives nearby and just wants to know more about him. While all this is going on, there's also rumors flying around about a leopard that has been freed and has been abducting children or what have you. And it's treated as just an urban myth until maybe it's not, when one of the boys who she was with is one of the people who's disappeared, they almost got together. And then Laura forms a strange sort of friendship relationship of a sort. It's not sexual, but with the writer, and it becomes clear that this leopard has something to do with his whole world viewpoint. And it's very NUI driven. Mm-hmm. It's very sort of like cynical, but there's something to be said for this being a Bildungsroman, a coming of age story, and that is unlike any other one I've seen before.
Yeah. And there's been an interesting trend, for these coming of age slash pseudo serial killer films that we've seen in the last 2 years. I mean, just at Fantastic Fest last year, we had My Friend Dahmer, which is a really good movie that sort of has the same kind of ideas. Another one that comes to mind, of course, is We Need to Talk About Kevin. Mm. But these movies that sort of equate, and this one, I think Savage is different. I think where Savage ends up with this character is certainly different than these other characters, which are overtly, you know, going to go on to do terrible things in life. But it is this idea of, you know, the tenuous nature of adolescence, of life and death, of beginning to realize, you know, have some of these heavy realizations about your life. And the story here is surprisingly gentle, I think, for what we've just described. Like, bad things do happen, but it does live in this sort of paradise community where these people have gather every year in order to live out their summer months. And this girl, this main character, is not somebody, I think, who knows. You know, a lot of times we're waiting for the character to build to this moment because we see something is wrong with them. We don't know necessarily if there's anything wrong with this character. She's weird. She's described as such. But how she sort of finds herself and the feeling out that she does with the writer next door, with her cousin, and how the movie resolves itself and how the movie resolves the leopard, which is an important element there.
Very important.
It is. I'm beginning to build a bit of a soft spot for films that deal with the idea of could you kill and also you're a teenager.
Yeah. There's a lot of that going around right now for sure. And as well, films that bring in surprising, this year is a definitely theme, surprising subtext that you didn't realize what that was until the very end of the film. She has sort of a weird conversational antagonism with a female detective that's mm-hmm. coming around who's like, yes, you're definitely a suspect in the disappearance. You were the last guy who was person who was with this kid. Yes, you're a suspect. But they have a weird thing that climaxes in a sort of, well, I didn't see that coming.
Yeah, it is a film where your read of a character changes entirely around one word. One word is spoken, and the relationship between the police officer and the girl and what they mean to each other and what especially she means to the officer, it all changes with one spoken word. And I think you'll know it when you hear it. It's just one of those moments where you're like, oh, that's really good. That's really smart. I really, you know, I like this movie, but that one moment there where these two characters just really locked into place with each other, I was like, I get it.
Yeah, the movie was starting to lose me in the middle where I'm like, I'm not sure what you're after. What are you chasing here? What are you trying to show us? Because it's kind of ambling for a bit. But I felt the ending very ably brings all these elements together in a way that is kind of mesmerizing, I thought. I mean, especially the thing with the said leopard. I was like, okay, there's a scene about the leopard in particular towards the end that is just like a showstopper of mm-hmm. a scene. I really enjoyed this. It's not going to be everybody's cup of tea because it is indeed a slow burn and maybe not what you'd expect once again with a title like Savage. But I do think this is really worth watching. And it's another one of many films this year at Fantastic Fest that specifically has that feel like we're definitely trying to be more inclusive of the idea of female protagonists and female voices. I do recommend this. Our third one we're going to talk about here is Donnybrook.
Speaking of inclusive, this is about as far from it, I think, as you can get.
Yeah, this is definitely one of the more machismo-driven films of the festival, to be sure, directed by Tim Sutton. But to be fair, he is making a brutal Southern Gothic neo-noir here, which almost is inseparable from, like, sort of toxic masculinity and machismo as a subgenre.
Yeah, this is a film that you're going to think based on the synopsis, because you'll read that Jamie Bell's character is about to participate in this bare-knuckle boxing fight in the middle of the backwoods in, you know, the heartland of America. And so you think, okay, this is just going to be like an action movie. This is going to be The Raid, but with rednecks.
Which, by the way, if anyone wants to make that movie, I will totally watch it.
I am on board for that as well. But it's actually, the film is a lot more of a juggling act between, yes, there are these grindhouse elements to it. There are these, you know, like hard-boiled characters with these ridiculous affectations that are out to murder and kill each other. But there's also an element of almost like a grounded, austere, again, we talked about the idea of poverty. This is another type of film. Somebody here, I can't remember who, described this as sort of like a contemporary post-apocalyptic film, which I think is actually a really interesting way to think about it. Is it for these people, the potential for a better world is gone. These are, you know, this $100,000 that they could win at the Donnybrook is a huge amount of money. And while you feel, when you hear that, like, okay, so this movie is either going to be very, very grounded or it's going to be very over the top, Donnybrook is sort of like, yes, I'm going to have it both ways. I'm going to have a ton of over-the-top sequences and some characters that you will probably never for the rest of your life forget. But I'm also going to dabble in the small moments, too. I'm going to think about how these characters interact with each other and what it means to live the way that they live. It is a strange film, but it is a film that I enjoyed, even though I have a hard time pinning it down.
Yeah, when you're talking about it feeling apocalyptic in a way, it feels post-America and feels very current at the same time. There's a very profound moment where at the Donnybrook itself, which just feels, like I said, it could be something in the Mad Max world almost to some degree, except without all the crazy Mohawks and stuff, just a bunch of big backwoods rednecks, where everything stops for them to do the Star Spangled Banner and like put their hands over their hearts and sing. And it just feels outrageously odd to watch it happening there. But the story is, Jarhead Earl, Jamie Bell, he's got a wife and two children, and he's, as you said, he's run out of options. There's just, as he says multiple times, there's nothing else left to do, and he's pretty much getting by only by small theft. And he's stolen enough to get the entrance fee to this fighting contest, the Donnybrook. And he's got to go across country to do it, and he leaves his wife and his daughter. His son comes with him, and it turns into kind of a road trip movie from at least his perspective as we're watching this voyage. On the other hand, we have the antagonists played here. Frank Grillo, who is playing the most psychopathic and scary character of his entire career, and that's saying something, is a heroin dealer who is chasing him, not necessarily him per se, but his own sister, who worked with him and has escaped after shooting him and presumably leaving him for dead. And he's like, well, I gotta catch my sister and do something horrible. But she ends up with Jamie Bell on said voyage. And it's kind of a cross-country trip across this, you know, lower than rural America. Very pastoral, even bucolic at points, especially in the third act. But at the same time, that feeling like civilization is kind of shut down.
Yeah, and there are, when I talk to people about this film, I kind of use the same line, which is that it's not a comedy, but it feels as if it was almost written to be one. Because there are the kind of exaggerated character elements where you think, all right, we're going to be in a dark comedy. And, you know, the Frank Grillo character gets picked up as a hitchhiker by somebody who brags about his, you know, middle-class American lifestyle and everything's gone right for him, stabs him in the neck just because he can. The sister, which I'm not going to spoil for you, has an entire thing that she does when she kills people that you sort of have to see to believe. And these are such exaggerated elements, such over-the-top bits that you're like, is this movie trying to be funny? But it never actually does. It just presents these interesting and unique characters, has some really weird touches. But on the other side, Jamie Bell, you know, you mentioned he's run out of options. His wife is actually a heroin addict, which is part of the reason why he wants to go there. You know, this movie bucks the trend of a lot of these films that we've seen and presents their domestic life as something really, you know, inspirational. They love each other. They care for each other. She's struggling with an addiction. He doesn't judge her for it. There are none of those scenes where he, you know, views her as being weak. So there are all these different things that are happening in this movie that are underneath this element of violence that is just on top of everything. I can honestly say I don't think I've ever seen anything like Donnybrook.
Yeah, it is, whereas I classify it as, like I said, Southern Gothic neo-noir, it is completely its own thing. I really enjoyed this. In fact, I enjoyed it so much, I got a chance to interview the director. I made a point of saying, hey, is there any way I can talk to him? And I sat down and had a longer than we planned on conversation because we were just having such a fun time shooting the shit, as it were, about his movie and about this genre that we both really love. And after I press stop, I will tell you about what he told me his next movie might be, which sounds amazing. I don't know if he wants me saying that on the air, so I'm going to have to keep that to myself. Listen to that. That is it for today's Fantastic Fest podcast. Keep listening to all the ones that we have on here that pop up on oneofus.net and austinchronicle.com. You can, of course, pick up Austin Chronicle at newsstands all over Austin, or you can go to austinchronicle.com and read lots of interviews, lots of reviews by this guy right here, Matt Monagle and Richard Whitaker.
Including my review of the Donnybrook.
Indeed, including his review of the Donnybrook. If you want to hear something without my annoying voice interrupting, you can just read his straight-up review there. But let's take a listen here to our interview with director Tim Sutton. So I am talking to Tim Sutton, the writer-director of Donnybrook. This is your third feature, is that correct?
Fourth feature.
Okay. And you, it looks like you've done some stuff that was both horror and kind of more arty. Mm-hmm. And this is you doing sort of like Southern Gothic neo-noir.
No, that's a good way to put it. Yeah. Yeah. My first three films are ethereal and kind of less on the narrative, more on the atmosphere. And what I tried to do with this film, not make a fight film, but make a like pure survival film.
Right. Yeah. And you emphasize that, especially the last lines of dialogue in the movie. It's like,
yeah, you got to fight for it.
In America today, some people have to go some pretty extreme lengths just to survive.
And this movie is like you say, the extreme version of that, with 20 people in a cage with fires in the background, and no one really wins the Donnybrook. Even if you do win, you lose something in the process. But how it relates to the rest of us is, it might be an extreme genre film, but it's also got universal themes. It's everyone needs to, at some point in their life, fight a little bit to get by.
I couldn't agree more. I've been through that maybe more times than I expected.
Me too.
When you're looking forward in college going, it's a bright, beautiful future for me, and then you didn't realize it was 10 or 20 of those times.
Yeah, it's just hard times.
I mean, when I fought in Donnybrook, it was not good. Was this actually based on something you heard of as a real thing?
Well, it's based on a great crime novel by Frank Bill, fantastic writer out of Indiana. And, you know, there's bare-knuckle fighting in kind of fight clubs all over the country and all over the world. But, you know, the actual Donnybrook that comes from his book is fiction. And what I tried to base the actual fighting on were these YouTube videos of Russian gangs. The Russian gangs go to the outskirts of Moscow, and it's 20 on 20, and it is the scariest shit you've ever
seen. So they really do that, where it's just like, go, and it's everybody on everybody. Yeah. I was not expecting that.
Yes. That's what I told the fight coordinators and the stunt coordinators and my producers. That's what it needs to feel like. Because if the fight doesn't work at the end, it's like you come to the end of Apocalypse Now, and, you know, if it's not the end of the world, it doesn't work. And we did the same thing with Donnybrook. Like, if that fight doesn't scare everyone to death, if you're not literally in the cage with them fighting for your life, it doesn't work.
And you got some really great actors for this thing. I am a big fan of both Jamie Bell and Frank Grillo. I have a question for you about Frank Grillo, though, yeah. And I have a bet going with some other critics.
Okay.
Did he insist on wearing that peacoat? Because it feels like he wears that in every single movie I've seen.
I'm pissed he wears it in other movies. Listen, that was the wardrobe, the costume designer, Mirren Crozier-Gordon, is this incredibly talented woman who is fitting Frank. And it turned out that coat was her assistant's brother's coat. And he was like, I love that coat. And when he put it on, it was clearly that he was becoming the devil and almost like a vampire type character. So instead of playing a hick, we went in that direction. But now he's wearing that coat all over the place. Not the exact same coat, but you know, Frank, the thing about this movie versus Frank's other movies is that this is real down and dirty. And this is, there's no superhero plot. It's just...
Or extreme purges.
Yeah, no, it's just nihilism through and through.
So what attracted you to this form of literature? Are you a fan of, like, Jim Thompson and things like that?
Exactly. I love crime fiction. Jim Thompson's a huge favorite
Dennis
of mine.
Dennis Lehane
I like. But I go back even to Dashiell Hammett.
Oh, yeah. Mindy's Lane.
Yeah. And Elmore Leonard. And this was kind of like, this felt like that genre, but nobody had done it with a meth-tinged breath. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And Frank Bill's writing is hard and sharp and dirty and punishing from the first sentence on. And what I tried to do was stay true to that language in creating the visual landscape, but kind of give it the soul of you know, families trying to survive.
There, I was noticing, once you move out of sort of the rural areas into the more pastoral, even bucolic landscapes, it seems like you were really enjoying shooting it. Like, mm-hmm. I definitely noticed a lot of, like, just gorgeous shots of just the trees and the plants blowing in the kind of creepy wind, and I was like, this guy is enjoying this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's you know, it's, you're traveling down a path, and that path goes deeper and deeper and deeper into darkness, but within all that darkness, there's a lot of beauty out there, too. Mm. And my first three films, they're very pastoral, they're very ethereal, and so what I wanted to do was kind of bring that soul with it, with me on this journey that's much more whole genre, narrative driven, but also just punishing. So you've been punished and you've been hit and you've been hurt and you've been stabbed, and then you get to just look at the trees and the wind for a little bit and like say, maybe it'll be okay.
Yeah, that's what I took from that. It was just these sort of moments, meditative moments, yeah, of like, but it's okay.
Yeah, it gives you a chance to catch your breath and be like, all right, what's next?
So I really enjoyed Margaret Qualley in this, yeah, film as well, who I've enjoyed in quite a few movies, including, The Nice Guys, of course, and then the deeply underrated show, The Leftovers.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Why isn't everyone talking about that?
I saw her in a clip. Just the one thing in The Leftovers where she just hugs. She hugged someone, and it was like this. It was so real. It couldn't have been acting. Like, it just felt like she was really hugging someone for dear life. And when I met her, we had the exact same criteria, which was we both just wanted to go all the way. And Margaret is one of those people who wants to be in vulnerable positions. She wants to go outside her comfort zone. She wants to be scared. She wants to give it everything she has. And as a filmmaker, that's what you look for in actors. You don't look for, you know, I talked to one actor who remained unnamed, who was like telling me how he thought he should be shot and the lighting should be, and what, he's not in the movie. And that's not this movie. You're looking for partners who just want to live on screen and possibly, you know, go as far as close to death as they possibly can.
Her relationship with Frank Grillo is fascinating, as brother and sister, and yet it feels that something even creepier under the surface there.
Yeah.
What kind of like directions did you give them as actors for that relationship, which is always tense and uncomfortable to watch on camera?
Well, I mean, the three of us really trusted each other as far as, like, you know, we all had the same intentions, which is make the most, you know, the most soulful, most interesting, most real and authentic movie we could. And so, for example, the scene when they're in the car together and he beats her down, you know, she just knows that something bad's coming because it always does. And he had to go further than normal to make sure she got the beating. And, you know, Margaret was actually in between takes telling Frank, like, you can, you know, let go. You can do it. You can do it harder. And Frank, you know, rose to the occasion. Everyone was safe on set at all times, but there had to be those moments between them that are real and filled with hate. And that's what you see on the screen. You see two people really trying to figure out, their lives together. There's really, awful moments in the film. Frank's character is a misogynist and is kind of almost a devil in the flesh.
They refer to him as such.
Yeah.
He's a raving psychopath.
Yes, he's Anton Chigurh reborn. And Margaret played it perfectly to the yang to his yin, as far as like this kind of wandering lost soul. So it's even harder when she gets it because she doesn't deserve it.
So the ultimate big fight scene the entire movie is leading up to, the Donnybrook, the fight that, like you said, I was expecting something a little more Fight Club,
uh-huh,
where it's very organized, uh-huh, even though we already know it's not because everyone's talking about Donnybrook.
Right.
But then it's this free-for-all. How did you choose to block and shoot that? What was involved in shooting a fight scene like that?
Well, I had never done it before, so I had a couple great fight coordinators, and it started out as you know, kind of showing me all these different moves that they could do, and I then showed them those Russian YouTube videos of gangs fighting, and what I wanted was this moment where the first 30 seconds it just, these 20 people turn into one form of arms and fists and teeth and chins and knees and pure chaos. I mean, Donnybrook in the dictionary is not only a fight, it's also chaos, and that's what I had to feel like. So we stripped down all and made it like the worst barroom brawl you could possibly be involved in. They went out. They choreographed it. They got half stuntmen, half regular guys who wanted to do it. Choreographed it over and over again. And then Frank and Jamie did one day of pure training with them in the cage. And then you know, you can't do a million takes of that. You got to let them fight it out. So we had two cameras on the day of the fight, and we just went for it. The thing that was most important is that authenticity. If it looks like you're not taking a hit, then the audience is going to be able to turn away.
So they all just said screw it and punched each other then?
Well, no. Originally that's what I kind of wanted, but my producer said there's such a thing as insurance.
Yeah.
No, it's just really well choreographed. And again, like, everyone in that ring gave a lot to the movie. They cared. They gave a shit, and we all really wanted this fight to feel real. And again, it was the last day of shooting. We had gotten to the Donnybrook collectively, all of us, in this dark, wooded area in Cincinnati, outside of Cincinnati. I mean, leave it all on the floor, and everybody did.
I heard an interview with Christian McQuarrie about the new Mission Impossible, and somebody asked him the question we all want to know: how is Tom Cruise insured? And yes. He goes, honestly, that's the biggest secret in Hollywood. No one knows.
Yeah. Tom Cruise has a death wish. He's incredible. The stunts in that movie are incredible.
Well, last question. Jamie Bell, in that final sequence, really breaks. He turns into this more sort of a taciturn guy early on in the film to this guy who you can see is shattered and literally terrifying to look at. Mm-hmm. Did he go through some special process as an actor that you saw
Absolutely.
To break himself in that way and just kind of go that far over the edge?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, Jamie is an incredible improviser and an incredibly soulful person. He saw the movie right from the beginning as a folktale and not just a regular kind of neo-realist look at you know, fighting. So he had that, he had the soul of the movie intact, but the reason that we cast Jamie and the reason that he's able to do that at the end is because Jamie's a dad. Jamie has a kid, and when you have a kid, and you're thinking about your kid in this movie, when your movie kid has been taken away from you, all is lost, and there's nothing left. And so Jamie was able to dig deeply, in the same way that that character Moses, the kid, is not in the book. I created that character because I have sons, and what's the scariest thing for me is to lose a son. So Jamie tapped into that, and, you know, it takes an incredible actor to do that and do it well.
It was very convincing and very scary. I don't have kids, but it made me go, well, I think that's how I would probably react
that's how it feels. Yeah, that's how it feels.
I don't know if I'd be able to take Frank Grillo, but I'll tell you right now, I wouldn't.
Well, Frank is like, you know, really, I gave up, Jamie. You didn't actually beat me. And Jamie's like, all right, buddy, whatever.
Frank is terrifying. Even when he's playing kind of a good guy, like in The Purge, I'm like, I'm not getting anywhere near that guy.
Yeah, he's vicious. I mean, which is really weird because in real life, he's a teddy bear.
Everybody who plays villains are always the sweetest actors, yeah, in my experience.
It's weird. It gives them a chance to act out, I guess.
Indeed. Know? Well, this has been Tim Sutton for Donnybrook. Can you tell us when people will be able to see this outside of festivals?
Yeah, IFC Films picked it up in Toronto and is going to be distributing the film early 2019. February, March.
Sounds awesome. You guys check out Donnybrook. I give it my full recommendation.
Thanks.